Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is The Entrepreneurial State by Mariana Mazzucato. And this is from the introduction titled Thinking Big Again. Across the globe, countries, including in the developing world, look to emulate the success of the U.S. economy. In doing so, they look at the power of, quote, market-driven, end quote, mechanisms versus what might seem like old-style state-driven mechanisms in places like Europe or the ex-Soviet Union. But the United States is not what it seems. The preacher of the small state free market doctrine has for decades been directing large public investment programs in technology and innovation that underlie its past and current economic success. From the internet to biotech and even shale gas, the U.S. state has been the key driver of innovation-led growth, willing to invest in the most uncertain phase in the innovation cycle and let business hop on for the easier ride down the way. If the rest of the world wants to emulate the U.S. model, they should do as the United States actually did, not as it says it did. More state, not less. A key part of this lesson should be to learn how to organize, direct, and evaluate state investments so that they can be strategic, flexible, and mission-oriented. Only in this way will top minds find it an honor to work for the state. This is something that needs to be understood not only by the rest of the world, but in the United States itself, where the dominant political narrative is endangering funding for future innovation and economic growth. In 2013, U.S. government spending for basic research fell below what it was a decade earlier, and most likely will continue to fall due to congressional gridlock over the public budget. Rather than static discussions about the size of the deficit, there must be more debate about its actual composition. How to invest strategically in key areas such as research and development, R&D, education, and human capital formation that will increase gross domestic product, the GDP, in the future, bringing the debt-GDP ratio down as a consequence. And how to engage in a debate about the direction of change so that such investments will lead to growth that is not only smarter, that is, innovation-led, but also more inclusive and sustainable. The United States desperately needs politicians with the courage to swim against the tide of popular rhetoric and outline a bolder vision for the state's dynamic role in fostering the economic growth of the future. In emerging economies such as China, the public sector is indeed investing billions in green technologies with the expectation that these industries will be the engines of future growth. The United States could take inspiration from its own history. In 1961, an American president set out a bold, ambitious, and risky mission to send a man to the moon. Who will have the courage to set out a new vision for America today? Addressing today's societal challenges, for example, those around climate change, requires a vision, a mission, and most of all, confidence about the state's role in the economy. As eloquently argued by Keynes in The End of Laissez-Faire, 1926, The important thing for government is not to do things which individuals are doing already and to do them a little better or a little worse, but to do those things which at present are not done at all. End of quote. This, however, requires the public sector to have vision and confidence, increasingly missing today. Why? What is the role of the public sector in economic growth? After the financial crisis, with public budgets bloated, mainly due to their role in saving the private sector, across the globe, we are hearing that in order for nations to be competitive, innovative, and dynamic, we must have more market and less state. As, at best, we are told, governments merely facilitate the economic dynamism of the private sector. At worst, their lumbering, heavy-handed, and bureaucratic institutions actively inhibit it. The fast-moving, risk-loving, and pioneering private sector, by contrast, is what really drives the type of innovation that creates economic growth. According to this view, the secret behind an engine of innovation like Silicon Valley lies in its entrepreneurs and venture capitalists. The state can intervene in the economy, but only to fix market failures or to level the playing field. It can regulate the private sector in order to account for the external costs companies may impose on the public, like pollution. And it can invest in public goods, such as basic scientific research or the development of drugs with little market potential. To some on the political right, even fixing market failures would be a sin, because such attempts would lead to worse outcomes in the form of government failures. What all these views have in common is the assumption that the state should stick to fixing markets, not directly trying to create and shape them. A 2012 Economist article on the future of manufacturing encapsulates this common misperception. This book is committed to dismantling this false image, which underpins a global trend promoted by conservative economists, politicians, and the media of bashing and diminishing the importance of the state. It focuses on what Tony Jute called a discursive battle. How we talk about the state matters. Depicting private business as the innovative force while the state is cast as the inertial one, necessary for the basics but too large and heavy to be the dynamic engine, is a description that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. The book is The Entrepreneurial State by Mariana Mazzucato.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you. In the studio with us is Nasreen Sheikh. She is the founder of the Empowerment Collective, empowerment collective.org, national speaker and global advocate for women's empowerment. Her Twitter handle is Resilient Her. There's also the website Nasreen Sheikh, NASREENSHEIKH.org. And then also the localwomenshandicrafts.com. And we'll get to all that stuff. Now, Serene, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tom, for inviting me here.
So glad to have you with us. You were born in a little village with no electricity, no running water. Just absolute utter poverty. You were, as a child, you worked in textiles.
Right, yeah. So I come from very, very small village, very small rural village on the border of India-Nepal, which is not even documented, which means like people who born in that village or dies in the village, the world does not know about them. In which condition they live, the world don't know about it. Every people who born in this village, we have no any document, so therefore I don't know how old I am. And I can guess maybe 28, 29, but I have no idea when my birthday is. In my village, when I was very young, I witnessed that female rights was very, very oppressed. Every single girl, like when I say every single girl, means every single girls, they were being forced into marriage by the age of like 15, 16, 18. And if they would turn by 21 or 22, they considered too old to get married. So it was kind of like a religious belief system or stigmas of this village that every parents, as soon they would have girls, they would arrange for their marriage all their life from the day that she borns, like she's treated differently. And not only that, I saw a lot of atrocities happening against women, and many of the women were like being hurt. But one of my aunt, she was being murdered because she spoke up, and she was loud woman, And one of my village aunt also, she was so oppressed that she burned herself. And I was around 7 or 8. And when I was like still very young, I witnessed that my own older sister, she was arranged into marriage when she was only 12. And I saw her crying and I saw her tears and how scared she was. And I asked my mom, like, why you are making her married? She's crying. And she said that, well, this is how it works. I did it. My mother did it. And now your sister is doing it. Someday you will have to do it too. This is how our society works. Like, I don't have any word to say. So when she said that, someday I will have to do it, that triggers me. And I felt like, oh my God, after my sister, I'm right now 8 or 9, but after my sister, I'm going to be the next. And so I started to feel, and I was looking for, I became very curious. And I had so many, like, I was looking for, is there anybody who's doing things differently? And I didn't have any role model, anyone to look up. And then I would ask my mom questions, and she would say, don't ask questions, because you're not allowed to ask any questions. And then I started to slowly getting isolated by the society, and I put a lot of my time going to the forest and going to the, in the nighttime in my village, we didn't have any electricity, no cars, no hospital, but in the nighttime the star would be very intense, like all the stars would give me a goosebumps when I would look up into the sky, because there was no electricity. And you know, slowly I felt more connected to the nature, and I started to pray more. And I decided by the age of 9 that I want to leave the village, and I decided to leave the village when I was around 9, and came to Kathmandu, which is the capital city of Nepal. And I found myself working with 6 others in 10 by 10 room with no clean drinking water. With in my food, I would always find a thread. We were working 7 days a week for 12 to 15 hours a day. I was doing single stitch for thousands and thousands of times. And I felt like a machine. I was thinking that I'm going to find a freedom for myself, but I found myself in another trap. And all I had is that I was keep being told by agent that I just need to keep finishing the pile of clothes that he was keep bringing. And it was 600, 700, 800 pieces a week. And we had to finish it no matter what. So we would wake up around like sometime 4 a.m., sometime 5 a.m. and work all the way to like 9, 10 p.m., 11 p.m. and still the pile of clothes are still left. And we knew that if we don't finish it, we will not get paid for all the work that we have done. So we have to finish it. So the people in that sweatshop, they used to give me hot pad of water that I could put in my eyes so I can stay awake. And they would put loud music on it so I can be awake and finish that task. But in that time, I started to cry, and I started to talk to the shirt again and said that to that t-shirt that I was making, that whoever is going to wear these t-shirts, I hope they can feel my energy, I hope they can feel my tears, I hope they can feel my blood. And it became my prayer. So every shirt I sewed, I prayed, and literally I felt like I was putting my tears, which is my suffering, into that shirt. So now in 2015, when I came to America and I walked to these department stores and realized where my clothes are being sold, I feel like people are consuming suffering unknowingly.
Wow. That's an extraordinary story. By the way, you have a YouTube talk out there, too, that people can find.
Yeah, TED Talk. TEDx Talk.
Yeah, I'm sorry, on YouTube. It lives on YouTube. So, Nasreen, tell us about the Empowerment Collective and local women's handicrafts.
When I was around 12, my sweatshop got closed. You know how fast fashion comes and it goes. When that happens, it affects the people like us who are the poorest of the poor. And then my sweatshop got closed after 2 years of operating. I had only 2 choices: either go back to the village and get forced into marriage just like my sister, or find for another sweatshop. I decided, so in that time, I decided that I will go back to the village because it was much more safe transfer. But in that time, while I was preparing myself to go back to the village, I became for a week like a almost like a street kid. And I would watch all these students going to the school, and that caught my attention because I was only around 12, and I wanted to be just like a normal student wanting to go to school, have a book, have a pen, and have a shoes, and just go to the school. And I couldn't. My reality was so different. So one day I was sitting on the street watching the student going to the school, and then one of the dog comes and sniff on me, and behind this dog is kind person, and he decided that he will, I asked him that if he can teach me, and then he became my teacher for the last 10 years, and I started to learn about human rights, I started to learn about what is women's empowerment, I started to learn about everything that I supposed to know as a human being, and when I was around only 13 and I didn't have any document, I decided to get a loan, and it was a big story again. It took me almost 3 months period of time to get $10 loan, which is 1,000 rupees. And finally, I got that loan. I bought my machine and I started to make the craft that I had a little bit of skill from that sweatshop. And I started to make my own crafts, and I started to sell to the other stores. And when I started to do on my own, I saw the difference that I was making. Before, I was getting less than $2 a day, working for 12 to 15 hours a day. Now I was working 8 hours a day, and I was getting like $5 a day, and that brought a huge economic independence in my life. And slowly, in Nepal, there's only 2% women on the business, and almost 85% of women are victim of the sweatshops. We don't even have the exact data research on it, so we don't know, but that's my guess. According, I have this research that our organization done, and so I decided that I want to teach more women skills and ethical fashions. That I love fashion, and fashion is a beautiful thing, like creativity, but at the same way it needs to be more ethically and produced in a way that it's coming from the creativity and love and connection, not from the the oppression. So local women's handicraft is basically a place for a woman who cares about sustainability and eco-friendly. We go to these big factories and we collect all these leftover fabrics, and we weave in a 100-year-old loom. All of our products are very, very like eco-friendly and natural hemp and beautiful embroideries. We make sure that all the women who works for us, they have, you know, health resources, education, living wage. And our empowerment collective, when I came to America for the first time in 2015, and I met with all these awesome women here in America, and they gave me hope big time, because I didn't had any hope when I was in Nepal. I was like, oh my God, this world is going to get into a really miserable place. But when I came to America and I talked to these conferences, and when I see all these powerful, amazing women coming together, it gave me hope. So I decided to register a nonprofit organization based in Chicago, and we are 501c3, and my goal is to raise fund to rescue these women who are the victim of the sweatshop. And we rescue them, we bring them to our training center, and we give them training up to 4 years. So in that 4 years, they learn who they are, they learn skills, they learn about basic educations, and they learn about their health. And in that, every day, 9 to 5, coming for 4 years, they're able to heal their trauma, and they're turning their trauma into power, and becoming advocate in the community and also social entrepreneurs. And like that, we have helped since 2008 almost hundreds of women, and my dream is to help 10,000 women by 2025.
Wow, that's extraordinary. We're talking with Nasreen Sheikh, who is the founder of the Empowerment Collective, empowermentcollective.org, and also Local Women's Handicrafts, all plural, .com, localwomenshandicrafts.com. The situation in Nepal that you were describing, and that's where you went when you were in Kathmandu, how unique is that relative to other countries around the world?
Like in what
in terms
ways?
In terms of child labor, basically, and sweatshop labor.
Yeah, I feel like Nepal is one of the least developed country in Asia, Southeast Asia. We are one of the poorest country, and we don't have much resources, and we don't have much system set up yet. So a lot of these sweatshops, they take advantage of the people. And we still have 1.6 million child labor in Nepal. All over the world, we have more than 200 million child labor. And these the governments and NGOs are trying very hard, but it's like it's really difficult because the big corporates like every time, like in the shop, like we have 50% discount, 80% discount, but we never talk about that. Hey, there is 1.6 million child labor that is might be contributing into all this t-shirt that is available for $5 or $10, you know,
right.
And people, like how many people even knows that one t-shirt takes almost 300 gallons of water to make, you know? And that 300 gallons of water one person can drink for years. So how can, like, same, like if one person wear their one clothes for extra 6 months, we will eliminate 1.5 million cars in a road, you know? Like, so there is like a fashion is the second most polluting industry in the world. So not many people knows that, and I feel like people need to become more responsible and aware, and information and knowledge is power. But I feel like at the same time, all the global leaders, especially the corporation leaders, they need to come and advertise and market the real message, you know, and the real truth. And I think that will help our planet, not only the human, but also our environment and other species that we are destroying. Like in Nepal, we used to have a beautiful river that used to run through the city. And just in my lifetime, when I came in the beginning, the river was still running. But now, when I walk through the river, I literally have to cover my mouth, and because it stinks so bad, all those industrial waste, human waste, are going passing through that river. So it's becoming filled, it's becoming rotten. And right now, people in Kathmandu, there is smoking 10 cigarettes a day, which means like the pollution is really, really bad. Yeah. So I feel like in this, we all are together, and this is a one world, and how we all can connect through the products that we buy, because everybody needs to wear their shirt, everybody uses their toothbrush, everybody uses their phones, the food, you know, but we are not connected. We don't know where it comes from, which condition that is made, you know. Right. And if we bring that attention, I feel like it will heal our planet in such an amazing way.
You were talking about just a moment ago about how the second most polluting industry in the world is fashion, how there are just in Nepal about a million and a half
1.6 million
1.6 million children working in this, and 200 million worldwide that we know of.
Yeah, that is what we think, but I was undocumented. So like my villages are undocumented, so we don't know how many more are there. So that is why I feel like people who are educated and aware, it's our responsibilities to know and ask questions, because I feel like 10 years ago, if somebody would have ask question where my clothes come from, these company would have been responsible, and if they would have been responsible, they have been tracked me, you know, they could have found me in that sweatshop, and I didn't had to live my life with trauma, because whenever I think of my childhood, I just have tears and you know, suffering and pain. So I feel like those people who are stuck in those darkness, they are looking up to us because we have that information. And many people in the villages, we didn't have any electricity and no information. And we think that this is our life, normal life, but we are being heavily oppressed. Like when I came to America in 2015, that is when actually I realized that I was a child laborer. Before that, in Nepal, it was so normalized that I didn't even understood the term of child labor in the sweatshop.
Right. So if I walked into a store in the United States and that's selling clothing and looked around, what percentage of the clothing that I'm looking at in a typical store in the United States is made with child labor?
America imports almost $3 trillion of products that contains sweatshop and child laborers.
Per year?
Yeah.
Wow.
$3 trillion.
So, I mean, our entire GDP is only $20 trillion. So that means that the vast majority of the clothing that we're...
No, it's like products. So it's like clothing, but also like other supplies and stuff, all these different types of products.
So all kinds of things are being...
Yeah. Trouble. Just to catch up on that, my father, he worked as a sweatshop person for the car industry as a welder. He made parts of car and he did welding, and his working condition was so terrible. He has a heat in New Delhi for like almost 100 degrees, and he worked outside with the heat, and then he lost his mind. Before I was even born. So
Nasreen Sheikh, check out localwomenshandicrafts.com. Thank you, Nasreen.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, empowermentcollective.org and localwomenshandicrafts.com. Gary in Baden, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Thank you.
Hey, Gary. Greed has no heart.
Greed has no heart ever. And that's what actually you're talking about.
You're right.
Yeah, it keeps coming back to that.
Everything is meta to that, it seems.
It always comes back to that, doesn't it, Tom Hartman?
Yep.
Maybe your show should be called today, Hopeful but Tempered by Reality.
Mm-hmm.
The reality, will voting be enough in 2020? So the jury's out. I am hopeful, but like you, and I've said it for a number of years, I was doubtful. To be frank with you, not to say anything more, but I was doubtful, but hopeful. So this is where we're at in America, 2019. And in closing, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt quote that he gave in the inauguration speech of 1936, when he said that the test of progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, but whether or not we provide too little for those who have more to those who have less that have too little.
I can't quote it verbatim either. But yes, absolutely. And better a government that has excesses of generosity, essentially, I forget how he phrased that, than is frozen in the ice of its own indifference as well. The other piece of that. Gary, thank you. We used to think new year, new me. Yeah, right. More like new year, new wrinkles. With every passing year, we all look older, but all that has changed now thanks to this magic in a bottle, Plexiderm Rapid Reduction Serum. It's like you turned back the clock instead of ringing in another new year. Plexiderm is a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. All you have to do is apply this powerful serum to problem areas, and within 10 minutes, voila, a new you. And the best part? No surgery or Botox involved. It's all natural. Ring in 2020 knowing Plexiderm is going to give you smooth, younger-looking skin in minutes. And the best part is, it goes on clear, so nobody even knows you're using it. Leave your under-eye bags and wrinkles in 2019 with Plexiderm. Go to TryPlexiderm.com and use my code Hartman, H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N, for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, half off plus an extra $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code Hartman. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use the code Hartman at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com, code Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is Measuring What Counts, A Global Movement for Well-Being by Joe Stiglitz, Jean-Paul Fattoussi, and Martine Duran. And this is from the first chapter labeled Overview. The high-level expert group on the measurement of economic performance and social progress, also known as HLEG, builds on the analyses and recommendations of the 2009 Commission on the Measurement of Economic Performance and Social Progress, also known as the Stiglitz-Sen-Fattoussi Commission, in highlighting the role of well-being metrics in policy and encouraging a more active dialogue among economic theory and statistical practice. The report makes explicit the often implicit assumptions hidden in statistical practices and their real-world consequences. Its central message is that what we measure affects what we do. If we measure the wrong thing, we will do the wrong thing. If we don't measure something, it becomes neglected, as if the problem didn't exist.
There is no simple way of representing every aspect of well-being in a single number in the way GDP describes market economic output. This has led to GDP being used as a proxy for both economic welfare, like people's command over commodities, and general welfare, which also depends on people's attributes and non-market activities. GDP was not designed for this task. We need to move beyond GDP when assessing a country's health and complement GDP with a broader dashboard of indicators that would reflect the distribution of well-being in society and its sustainability across the social, economic, and environmental dimensions. The challenge is to make the dashboard small enough to be easily comprehensible, but large enough to summarize what we care about the most. The 2008 crisis and its aftermath illustrate why a change in perspective is needed. The GDP loss that followed the crisis was not the temporary one-off event predicted by conventional macroeconomic models. Its effects have lasted over time, suggesting that the crisis caused the permanent loss of significant amounts of capital, not just machines and structures, but also hidden capital in the form of lower on-the-job training, permanent scars on young people entering the labor market during a recession, and lower trust in an economic system rigged to benefit a few. Different metrics, including better measurements of people's economic insecurity, could have shown that the consequences of the recession were much deeper than the GDP statistics indicated, and governments might have responded more strongly to mitigate the negative impacts of the crisis. If, on the basis of GDP, the economy is perceived to be well on the road to recovery, as many governments believed in 2010, one would not take the strong policy measures needed to support people's living conditions suggested by metrics that inform on whether most of the population still feels in recession. Nor would one take measures to bolster the safety net and social protection in the absence of metrics on the extent of people's economic insecurity. These failings in the policy responses to the crisis were compounded by overly focusing on the consequences of public spending and raising government's liabilities, when this spending could take the form of investment, increasing the assets in governments' and countries' balance sheets. The same follows when measures of unemployment do not reflect the full extent of a country's unused labor resources. The beyond GDP agenda is sometimes characterized as anti-growth, but this is not the case. The use of a dashboard of indicators reflecting what we value as a society would have led, most likely, to stronger GDP growth than that actually achieved by most countries after 2008. This book also looks at progress in implementing the recommendations of the Stiglitz-Sen-Fitoussi Commission since 2009, identifying areas that require increased focus by statistical agencies, researchers, and policymakers. The UN Sustainable Development Goals, agreed by the international community in 2015, clearly go far beyond GDP. But their 169 policy targets and more than 200 indicators for global monitoring are too many to guide policies. Countries will have to identify their priorities within the broader UN agenda and upgrade their statistical capacities, which, even in developed countries, are insufficient to monitor whether the agreed-upon commitments are being met. The international community should invest in upgrading the statistical capacity of developing countries, especially in areas where country data are needed to assess global phenomena, such as climate change or the world distribution of income. Inequality in income and wealth has today a central role in policy discussions in ways it did not in 2009. But important progress is still needed in a range of areas, such as measuring what happens at both ends of the income distribution, integrating different data sources, and measuring the joint distribution of income, consumption, and wealth at the individual level. When looking at inequality, it's also important to look at differences between groups. These are called horizontal inequalities, at inequalities within households, and the way resources are shared and managed, which are especially important in the case of wealth. We should also look beyond inequality in outcomes to inequality of opportunity. Inequality of opportunity is even more unacceptable than inequality of outcomes, but the operational distinction between the two is fuzzy, as we don't observe all circumstances that shape people's outcomes and are independent of their efforts. The book Measuring What Counts by Joe Stiglitz and friends. Robin in Kingston, Washington. Hey, Robin, what's up?
Why religion is descending. I believe this, I'm sort of atheistic or agnostic. I believe that religion is a process that keeps men in control. And that entire element is ending. And the Gutenberg press thing still was able to be withheld from women, but the internet is not. So the internet is this era's Gutenberg press, and that's why women are just standing up. An example of this would be Kashama Swant, a socialist in Seattle. 4 or 5 years ago when she started out, I would drift over. I'm on the other side of the sound, but I'd support and do what I could to help out. And I kept on encouraging her to form a new party, a new socialist party called the Eco-Socialist Party, Economic Socialism and Ecological Socialism. And I told her 5 or 6 times she didn't do that. And then all of a sudden, blink, all of a sudden somebody has invented that, and that is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with the Green New Deal. That's exactly what that is. So I just wanted to tie in a few things that you have been talking about, and clearly the Green New Deal is the citizens' pushback to corporate and bankster control of a capitalistic society. So this is exact. You have it right. This is a battleground, so stand up or lay down. So. You know, get engaged, everybody. So this is a blast. Also, just wrapping it up, once you open up the discussion about politicians, the Democratic candidates, I'm going to tie in Buttigieg. My observation is that Pete Buttigieg is a Manchurian candidate coming out of the military-industrial complex, and he is to the left what John McCain is to the right. Military intelligence. McCain wasn't gay, I don't think, but he speaks smoothly with Harvard speak. So you will find out that Buttigieg is in position to get the droppings from either whether Joe Biden failed or whether he could be part of the particular campaign.
Yeah, clearly both Mayor Pete's strategy and Amy Klobuchar's strategy, Senator Klobuchar's strategy is if Joe Biden falls, I'm the guy or the woman, I'm the person to catch that. And yeah, this story, which has got a lot of people going, whoa, that came out that Mark Zuckerberg and his wife were personally advising Buttigieg's campaign on who they should hire, is, I think, giving a lot of people a lot of pause. And maybe, hey, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking advice from smart, wealthy people on the one hand. On the other hand, is there more to it than that? I think a lot of people are waiting to find out. I'm not sure I'm ready to call him a stalking horse, but Robin, I absolutely get what you're talking about. Thank you for the call. Susan in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'd just like to make a point in the talk of democracy and restoring it. We can actually look at the campaigns right now, in my opinion. When you don't have corporate donations in your campaign, that's a sure sign as you're letting people decide. Mm-hmm. And Bernie is almost successful at that.
Yep. I mean, and Elizabeth Warren is doing really well, too. They were within $500,000 of each other in terms of total donations. And they're both at the top of the pack, and neither one of them are taking corporate money or billionaire money. And, you know, I think
that's can help us.
I think what it does is it tells all of us that small d democracy, you know, grassroots power, people, American people still believe in the idea of democracy, and they still believe in the possibility that the American government can actually work for the average person instead of the billionaires. And I suspect that a lot of Americans have figured out how difficult that's going to be. Bernie or Elizabeth Warren become president, they're going to have to take on the Supreme Court. They're going to have to take on the Koch brothers. They're going to have to take on the entire institutional Republican Party. They're going to have to take on big corporations like Amazon and Facebook. It's going to be war, politically speaking. But if we don't have this, if we don't get through this, I think all is lost. Susan, thank you. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Andrew Baer. He is the CEO of As You Sow, a member of the UN Sustainable Stock Exchange Green Finance Advisory Group, and the author of The Shareholders Action Guide, Unleash Your Hidden Powers to Hold Corporations Accountable. The website is asyousow, asyousow.org. And Andrew's Twitter handle is both at As You Sow and Andrew Behar, or Baer, B-E-H-A-R. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us about shareholder activism in a green way in this modern world. Tell us about As You Sow.
So As You Sow has been around since 1992, and we focus on corporate accountability. We are shareholders, and we represent shareholders, and we talk to corporations about a range of issues, mostly relating to risk that corporations have around climate change, environmental health, human rights, slavery and supply chain, ocean plastics. So a range of environmental, social, and governance issues. And we open a dialogue with a company and talk to them about how they can reduce their risks and improve their brand.
Cool. I understand that there is a company that you are specifically trying to influence right now, that being Facebook. Tell me about that.
So we feel as Facebook shareholders that the company's really lost its way, that right now there's 45 million images of child pornography and torture that they've been affecting.
Literally at this moment, you mean?
Literally at this moment.
On Facebook?
And on Facebook. It's the biggest center for child pornography in the world, I believe.
Wow.
And they also have influenced, basically put people's lives in danger. For instance, in Myanmar, people are putting out posts that people think are true, and then they go out in the streets and commit murders. They've basically, their advertising in terms of their political ads allow lies, which is something that CBS, NBC, all the broadcast networks are not allowed to do. So somehow Facebook is above the law, and they've really lost their way as a company. I don't think this was the intention of the company, and Facebook employees have written an open letter to management saying, we don't want this to happen, and shareholders are not happy, and also people who have Facebook accounts are starting to turn them off. So as shareholders, we think this is a material risk to the company.
But doesn't Mark Zuckerberg either own a majority of the shares or a large enough minority of the shares that he has effective, absolute, tyrannical control over the company?
Mark Zuckerberg has a 10-to-1 voting preference. So last year, for instance, we co-filed with Trillium Asset Management on a resolution to separate the board chair from the CEO. It got an officially a 20% vote, but that was 60% of independent voters. So yes, he does have authoritarian control over the company, but even so, again, employees, shareholders, and users are all advising him to take a look at where the company's gone, and our resolution is titled Reboot Facebook, to actually have a fresh start and to really implement what the mission of the company is, which we believe has just gone down the wrong path, and they need to do a real reboot to recover.
Yeah, it's a hashtag reboot Facebook. Is this a shareholder resolution, is there a shareholder meeting coming up that you're specifically focused on, or is this an ongoing campaign?
There's an annual meeting that's happening basically 6 months from the filing date of a resolution. You have an annual meeting. Mm-hmm. So it's in probably in the end of June kind of thing.
Okay, so this is coming up next summer.
Right.
So you're trying to organize people right now to be activists in this. And you, do you have to own at least one share of Facebook stock in order to participate?
You have to own $2,000 worth of Facebook stock for a year.
I see. So that's going to be outside of the ETFs, you know, of that's going to be a fairly limited number of people, isn't it? Or is Facebook stock widely distributed? I've never, you know, I don't. I don't own pretty much any stock right
Facebook's
now.
Facebook's largest stockholders are BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, all the big indexing asset owners. And we hope that they will vote for this resolution and support us, as well as supporting those other resolutions at Facebook as well. Again, trying to, the governance one, splitting the board chair from the CEO.
Yeah.
But we would like all Facebook shareholders to vote for this resolution. We think that it's a real clear call for Facebook to shift their trajectory.
So I think it was in the Financial Times a couple of days ago, there was a fascinating article about how if you hold stock through one of these big companies, you know, where people put their 401ks and whatnot, that you're actually voting, and very often you're voting against your own interest. And they looked at the voting behaviors and found that BlackRock, for example, more often voted with management. Vanguard more often voted with shareholders in shareholder resolutions challenging management. But they're basically voting your shares. Am I recalling that correctly?
It's the New York Times on Sunday.
Ah, okay.
And it
was
called Want a Bigger Say, Move Your Money. No, BlackRock and Vanguard both vote 93% against shareholders. They basically support CEO pay.
It was Fidelity, I think, that was doing well, right?
There's a few fund managers that actually do better than others, but in general, the big ones. So BlackRock is $7 trillion, Vanguard's about the same, State Street is in there. So we're talking like $20 trillion of assets. Basically vote with management, so they're voting for the worst climate deniers and climate polluters. They're voting for ocean plastics. And we even had an incident where we put a resolution forward that was to try to fight slavery and supply chain, and BlackRock voted against us.
Wow.
They decided that they wanted to support the company's belief that they didn't have to disclose or do anything about slavery in their supply chain.
If somebody has their money with, you know, one of these big funds, or if somebody doesn't own any stock, I mean, what can people do who are not specifically Facebook shareholders with your Reboot Facebook campaign and presumably any other campaign for corporate accountability?
So there's 91 million people with $8.5 trillion of assets in 401k plans, which means they're invested in mutual funds and ETFs. And AsYouSow actually built a whole suite of tools called Invest Your Values. If you go to AsYouSow, AsYouSow.org, right at the top, you'll see Invest Your Values. If you click there, you can then look at fossil fuels, you can look at gender inequality, you can look at weapons, you can look at deforestation. And you just type in the name of the ticker of your mutual fund, and it will tell you exactly. You'll get a report card, and you'll get a D in deforestation and an F on military weapons. You'll get a B in climate change. And then you can click and you can actually see every company that you hold. Mm-hmm. So we believe in people investing aligned with their values. And most people don't even understand that they're in a mutual fund or that a mutual fund is a basket of stocks and that it may not be aligned with what they believe in. So we believe, number one, figure out what you own. Now, once you figure out what you own within your 401k plan, you can move, let's say you're invested in a fund that's getting an F on deforestation. So they've got companies that are burning down the Amazon and the Indonesian rainforest. And there might be another fund that gets a B or an A. You could just take you 2 seconds to shift your money over to that other fund. Now, you've just made a major statement, and the capital has left that fund and went to the other. The other thing you can do is we're going to be adding an action button. You could click, and it will check that you own those shares, and then you can send a message to the fund manager saying, I don't like that you own companies that are burning down the Amazon or Facebook, and I also want you to vote your proxies in a certain way. Mm-hmm. So vote for this resolution. So there's a lot you can do to become a really strongly empowered shareholder.
That's great. Andrew Baird is the CEO of As You Sow, AsYouSow.org, right? Yeah, .org. There we go. Andrew, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Keep us up to date on how it's going. Andrew Baer. Janet in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you tell me, do you have any data on how many people are leaving the United States because of Trump and the Republicans?
I don't. The problem that people would have is that a lot of other countries, the developed countries, European countries mostly, and Canada, won't take us. So I doubt there's that many people leaving.
Why won't they take us?
When George Bush was elected, and I wasn't doing this radio show, Louise and I were living in Vermont, and we were retired. I had sold a business. I checked in with the Norwegian government to see if we could emigrate to Norway, because I thought George W. Bush was going to be the beginning of the end for this country. My father's 100% Norwegian, you know, so I'm 50% Norwegian. Their immigration policies were so rigorous. I mean, you've got to be fluent in Norwegian. You've got to pass all kinds of tests. You've got to have a certain level of assets. You've got to have, I mean, it's just really tough. Most of these countries have pretty severe requirements to become citizens. And Canada does too. And in fact, a good friend of mine who's a physician, who's my age, went to Canada. This was 15, 20 years ago, moved to Canada, got a job as a professor at one of their universities and opened a private practice on the side. And when he got into his mid-50s and he had an illness and suddenly Canada was looking at him as somebody who's going to get expensive as he gets older, they discovered, in quotes, and he'd been living there for like 6 years, right, working and everything, had a visa and was on his way to applying for citizenship, and they discovered that he had a speeding ticket in the United States that he'd paid. But a speeding ticket is technically a crime, and so they kicked him out of Canada for being a criminal.
my God.
Yeah, because it
was, I did not know that.
Yeah, and the real reason was, you know, he was 56, 57, something like that, and they were just looking at him as, you know, a long-term liability. They aggressively discourage older people from emigrating to Canada. So I doubt very many people are leaving the United States. One of my closest friends from back in college days is spending 6 months out of the year down in Mexico. But then there's a lot of Americans who do that. There's huge expat communities in Mexico, in Costa Rica, and some of these other countries. But most of them are not living there permanently. And the ones who there are some, and Panama also. But I doubt that that's an exodus because of politics. I think that's more people looking, you know, people who've retired, they've got a pension, they've got Social Security they can live on. In those countries, you can have a really high standard of living on your retirement, basically. You can, you know, duck, duck, go, that stuff. But anyhow, Janet, I got to run. Thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you here on the Tom Hartman Program. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no. Who came up with that crazy idea? Oh, Supreme Court? It's even crazier.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
Steve in Whistler, Canada. Hey, Steve, what province is that in?
That's in British Columbia.
Cool. So what's on your mind today?
I know a lot of the Americans don't like Canadians telling them about the politics and all that sort of stuff. So I'm not going to say anything, you know, other than...
Hey, you're entitled to say anything you want, Steve. This is an opinion show.
I like the system that we have here in our country, and I think Bernie is, in Canada, and I think Bernie is probably almost needed to help bring things around.
If Bernie's policies were put into place in the United States, would the United States resemble Canada, or would we have surpassed Canada in terms of being more like Denmark, being more like a nation that actually takes care of its people?
You know, it's going to be a work in progress for sure. If you look at Medicare for All, you know, with the hearing, the dental and visual, you know, that's better than what we have right now. So, but look, I want to actually ask a question with regards to the impeachment. If Trump is found guilty, which he clearly is, and he's removed from office, how is it possible for the laws, in particular his executive orders and all of the vetoes, how is that possible that a lawless president can actually create the laws?
If he is found guilty and removed from office, it will not negate the things that he did, because when he did them, he was the lawful president of the United States. He just won't be able to issue any more executive orders after he gets convicted, God willing. That's the simple reality, Steve. If we're going to undo Trump, the way to do it is to elect an overwhelming majority of Democrats, like more than 67 seats in the Senate, and certainly, you know, a clear majority in the House of Representatives, and then have a progressive in the White House. If we can do those three things, we have a really good chance of turning this country around in a positive direction and making this a place where the American dream is the American dream again. Because right now, social mobility is probably the biggest definition of the American dream. And if you look at the 34 OECD countries, the 34 richest countries on earth, we are at the bottom in terms of social mobility. We're just literally at the bottom. So
yeah, well, I wish you guys the best of luck, and I hope that that the American population makes the right decision.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, I do too. I do too. Thanks a lot, Stephen. Thanks for watching us up there in Canada. It's great talking to you. Katie in Hamul, California. Hey, Katie, what's up?
Well, hi, Tom. I've been in Australia. I finally got my citizenship. I don't know if you remember me, but I call occasionally when I'm back here.
You called like a year or so ago and said,
I'm working on the accent.
It was like a year or so ago you called and you said, I'm out of here. You know, enough of this Trump stuff. I'm leaving the country.
No, that was some gentleman. I felt really bad for him. I thought, geez, he needs to just marry an Australian. I remember him. No, I've called about, I've called for years off and on, but we have a terrible prime minister there, and it has a lot to do with Facebook. But yeah, no, I've just been getting their medical benefits for years because my husband's Australian, our kids live there.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, he retired here from the University of California, went to Australia, and so I stayed there long enough to get my permanent residency. And when I got my citizenship, I went up to the lobby, I said, I want to register to vote. She said, you just did. You just sign the paper. So they register you as soon as you get your citizenship. What bothers me terribly, everything does, because I'm an old street fighter from the 60s here in San Diego, is that my stepdaughter in Melbourne married a person so similar to Trump that it's scary. And he's a big Trump supporter. And so I have been doing the past couple of years a lot of studying. I mean, there's professionals that could speak for me about this narcissistic personality disorder, malignant. And what I've learned, kind of already knew from social work, but is that when they're old, when they're dying, when they feel their body giving out, they want the whole world to feel their pain. They want everybody to suffer. And this is what I look at him, and particularly like if he looks at Justin Trudeau or something, he is angry that he is not, that he's not immortal.
Right.
And so if he's going to suffer and die, this is what really worries me and reminds me so much of this now ex-husband of my stepdaughter's, then, damn it, everybody's going to suffer and die.
Right. And I don't know, an example.
I'm going to hand that off to you as a student of psychology. What do you think?
I agree. And you want an example from history. Watch the movie. You can see it online now, Downfall. It's a movie about Hitler's last days. And when the young courier, the 16-year-old courier, goes in and hands him the papers that say that the war is lost. There's nothing more that can happen. That courier was a friend of mine. His name is Armin Lehman, and he wrote a book called Hitler's Last Courier. Yeah. And Armin told me this story. And Hitler ordered his generals to keep fighting and keep recruiting 12, 13, and 14-year-old boys, because they'd gone through all the 15 and 16-year-olds, and the men were all dead. And he said, you guys keep fighting. And then he went in the other room and shot himself and his wife, Eva Braun, who had just become his wife. And that's exactly what you're talking about, Katie. I mean, Hitler suffered from malignant narcissistic personality disorder, just like Donald Trump does. That's not to say that Trump is as smart as Hitler was, but they both have that personality disorder, and they both want the entire world to end if they're going to end. Or at least Hitler did, and I would assume that Trump would too. And that's one of the other things, you know, Dave called earlier, the intelligence officer called up and said, you know, I'm watching what's going on in the Middle East with regard to Lebanon and Iran.
Yeah, I heard that.
And yeah. I'm concerned that Trump is setting up an October surprise, you know, to help win the election, which will be a limited war in the Middle East. And
Hitler ended it in a way that Trump never would. He ended
with suicide.
Himself. And I don't see that happening. But
I don't know. Don't underestimate a narcissist who is cornered. You know,
that's my point.
and mine too. You know, I think it's very possible that Donald Trump would take steps that might cause World War III in order to prevent losing power or being imprisoned or anything like that. Katie, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Give my best to your family. Let's see here. Merle in Seattle watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Merle, what's on your mind today?
On what's on your mind there. I think you got some great stuff going on there. I listened to your Fridays with Bernie for some time. Really appreciated it. Going to a topic here, I think has to do with where you discussed how Bernie does not espouse a takeover or private sector in the private sector sphere of operations.
Right.
Instead, much like down there in Portland, where your planning commission is proposing private building owners would have to set aside areas on their property for street camping. I don't know if you heard about that.
I have not heard about that.
Up here, we have a candidate who's a little bit different from Sanders' persuasion, which might be democratic socialism. But she's the first one to propose what they have in France, which is a non-eviction standard for people who are having trouble paying their rent between the months of November and March. But Bernie, for his part, subscribes actually to a form of takeover of this sort. He calls it a seizure of the energy industry in his Green New Deal. I don't know if you've
I'm familiar with that, and I support that because, you see, this is the question of where's the commons. You can only have one power line coming into your house. And so these are natural monopolies, just like you can only have one water line coming into your house and one sewer line leaving your house. And that's why those things never should have been privatized in the first place. Half of all the power in the United States right now is generated by power companies that are owned by cities, counties, or states. Or in the case of the TVA, even, it's a standalone nonprofit, but it was started by the federal government under Franklin Roosevelt. And the other half of the power in the United States is produced by private for-profit companies. And the record between the two is dramatic. The private for-profit companies have more outages, poorer service, higher rates.
More fires.
Yeah, more fires, more decrepit. So just like I don't think that there should be private water companies, I don't think that there should be private power companies, but that's a huge step from doing like the Soviet Union did where, you know, there's only one company in the entire country that made cars. They were called Lotas. And they were terrible cars, two-stroke engines, and that company was owned by the government. There was only one company that made televisions. It was owned by the government. Basically, literally every company was owned by the government. I don't want the government making my blue jeans or my car or my stereo or my computer, and neither does Bernie Sanders. So
stress that language in his Green New Deal that yeah. He's calling for completely sustainable energy sector, which would be in essence a seizure of the current.
That's the nationalization of the energy sector. Yeah, you're right. You're right. But because it is a natural monopoly, I think it's a completely different thing from seizing companies that actually compete with each other. You can't have competing power companies. I can't choose.
He's talking about an energy sector, really. Yeah, so much a private sector.
But. Right, and that's what we need to do. So, yeah, Merle, thanks for the call. That's a good clarification. Appreciate it. We'll be back with more of the news and more of my thoughts and yours in this kind of national town hall meeting we have here every day on the Tom Hartman program. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Never was intended to be. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.